Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Calling Tau City, turn on your radio. I know we had some words last time, but that was so long ago. I got your message. It was a little harsh, you know. It's still a little hard for me to hear. Please take it slow.
Welcome to Starship Sofa, part of the District of Wonders Network. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
I'm tuning in to your transmissions. I'm rooting, waiting to be found. And I'm building rockets. I'm pointing them to the moon.
This is the Starship Sova, everybody. Welcome, hello, and welcome to show 732. I'm your host, Tony C. Smith. Hello, everyone. Hope everyone is fine and dandy. I am having the first sips of coffee this morning. That's how early it is. It is 6 o'clock in the morning when I'm recording this story. What a show. I'll tell you what's coming in today's show. We have Oasis on the Edge of Trappist by Chris Balliet. And we also have our very own Amy H. Sturgis. Yes, we're looking back at genre history. That's all coming in today's show. I do hope you'll stick around and enjoy it. So yes, before all that, we are still chundling away there with the new podcast, Sofa Nods. I hope you enjoy them little kind of snippets I did last week. And we'll certainly keep plugging away and doing it. But we are kind of, I think, 4 shows in there now. And the show that's going to come out this Thursday coming, we recorded. And it was just a comedy of errors anyways. But the software, this is what gets us excited. The software is remarkable, you know, what we use now from what, I don't know if anyone even remembers or anyone's kicking around that when we used to do the Sofa Nauts, actually it was called the Sofa Nauts conventions, you know, it was such like wobbly software anyways, but cost a small fortune, absolute fortune, you know, and we were allowed, like, say 50 or 100 people in this, into this virtual auditorium. Now it's just, and AI can just pull like show notes, give you titles, give you umpteen titles, give you keyword searches, all sorts, you know what I mean? It just, everything comes, just, you just speak your words and it's all, you press a button, the audio is sorted out for you. I mean, at this moment on where I'm recording, that doesn't happen. I do the audio kind of increase and I tweak it a little bit just to get everyone's voice level, you know, so there's, because when you get the software, when you get the audio files in from different people, the quiet, the high, and I've just done that, you know, naturally, after nearly 20 years of sitting here, you get used to it. But it's just all done. Do you know what I mean? It's all done. Crazy. You press another button and AI will go through it and cut out the little, what I'm kind of normally, you know, all the kind of messy things, man. It's just bizarre. But we also had Evo Terra, and it was just an honour to have him on. And he had to get up at 5:30 in the morning to get it recorded. You know what I mean? God loves a trooper. But Evo Terra, he was like one of the very first. You know what I mean? He was Slice of Sci-Fi. He even wrote the book, Podcasting for Dummies. Do you know what I mean? Then sold it all and up with his wife, Sheila, just went round the world travelling. You know what I mean? And actually used to send us postcards from every destination. Do you know what I mean? So, but I'll put links again to the show. You know what I mean? Please, Apple or Spotify or whatever podcast, just do that. It would be fantastic. Now, this story you're about to hear is an original, The Starship Sova, Oasis on the Edge of Trappist by Chris Balliet. I'll give a little heads up about Chris. Chris is a speculative fiction writer who lives in Philadelphia with his wife and daughter, traversing the city in search of playgrounds and good coffee. He is a graduate of the Taos Toolbox in 2023 and has a degree in history and finance that inspire his work. And you can find him at Threads, Instagram, and there's just a whole load of come to the website, and there's loads of, and there's even a chrisbelliot.com. So this story is narrated by Mark Nelson. Mark Nelson began his audiobook narration in 2006 and now has over 180 titles at LibriVox and recording as Harry Shaw, more than 100 for Audible. While Mark mainly records sci-fi, fantasy and horror titles, he's also ventured into the classics of Hugo and Dostoevsky. So The Starship Sova is very proud to present On the Edge of Trappist by Chris Balliet.
Loser, lowlife, leech. I can't stop repeating the words that my wife screamed on her way out the door when she took our daughter and left for good. Everyone told me time would numb the pain, but 10 months later it hasn't, because she was right. I took this contract to show her that I'm a new man, willing to risk it all to win them back. Of course, the odds fucked me again. Blinded by the life-changing payout, I came to this ball of ice at the edge of the Trappist system to prove that I'm capable of providing for my family. All I needed to do was bring back a sample of the radiotrophic organism that somehow survives on this dwarf planet. To a gambler like me, the dough always outweighs the danger. That's probably why nothing ever seems to go my way. Now I'm shivering in the cockpit of the broken-down boat I got on the cheap, waiting for the vestiges of life support to dissipate. My wife always told me, you get what you pay for, and I guess she was right about that, too. As I see it, there's only two options. Sit here until I freeze into a human popsicle, or venture out, find a warmer place to shack up, and pray to every god there is that someone finds me before I run out of water, food, or both. At least this decision feels easy. I'll always choose to fight for my family. I rip open the emergency cabinet at the rear of the small cargo hold, which I should have checked before leaving civilization behind. Details have never been my thing. I'm expecting it to be empty and feel the tension loosen from around my stomach when I see that it's not. Two vacuum-certified survival suits are hanging from a rusted metal bar. One is worn and ripped in several places, not even worth salvaging for materials. The other is two sizes too big, but looks to be in decent enough shape to risk the vacuum on the dwarf planet's surface. I slip on the oversized orange rubber suit, drag up the zipper to create a seal, and twist on the metal helmet. When the visor's HUD activates, I'm elated to see that the battery has enough juice to give me a fighting chance, and the onboard oxygen tank is three-quarters full. I'm about to step into the frigid wasteland when I see the angled black metal edges of a reconnaissance probe peeking out from under a tan tarp in the far corner of the hold. The seller threw it in to sweeten the deal, and I didn't get rid of it because finding a place to dump its micro-reactor was too much hassle. Now the hexagonal hunk of junk that came with the boat will be my salvation. I bound across the icy hellscape behind the nuclear-powered reconnaissance probe, covering a significant distance with each low-G leap. The probe's exhaust heat, the very weakness that rendered it obsolete 5 wars ago, protects me from a frigid death. A good recon probe should be stealthy and hard to detect. This one, built for long-term monitoring missions on the frontier, is the opposite. Any boat that gets within a few kilometers of this frozen dwarf planet won't miss the heat plume on their thermal scopes. It's going to be my nuclear-powered smoke signal. Military boats don't come out this way anymore, but plenty of freighters, pirates, and idiots like me cruise the frontier of Trappist. If they've got scopes on, they'll notice the probe, come down to investigate, and find me. I'll hitch a ride to wherever they're headed and then work my way back home. I keep on going until the probe detects a concentration of inverted fungal caps and their fluttering gills a few kilometers ahead. They look like giant receiving antennas, poking through the ice to nourish themselves with cosmic radiation. Strange that my boat didn't identify them when I scanned the surface from orbit. That's just my luck finding the contract's query with little hope of getting home to collect my payday. I've patched into the probe sensor suite to display terrain anomalies on my HUD. It highlights the outline of a chasm between several of the skyscraper-sized caps. My gut screams to check it out, and I've learned to trust my instincts. The hole is wide enough to swallow the boat I left behind and runs too deep to see the bottom. As I lean over the edge, I feel my stomach lurch, expecting gravity to rip me down to my demise. My palms get sweaty. I pull away. I haven't adjusted to the low gravity of this place yet and still hate heights. But the underground beckons me. Maybe I can survive down there. It might be deep enough to offer some shelter from the cold. I decide to leave the probe behind and activate its distress beacon with an automated process to notify me if it picks up a response signal. My call for help won't reach civilization for a few months from this far out, but it's another factor that improves my chances of being found. In the worst case, someone will find my body and let Cal know that I died trying to make things right. I just need to survive long enough to beat the odds. Deb, my wife of over a decade, would be glad if I died out here. I never opened the divorce paper she sent me right before I took this contract. She thought I was a bad influence on Cal, teaching her things that would lead down the same dark path I traveled. I just tried to be a good dad in the only way that I know how. Not like I had any good examples to learn from to know how to do it right. Coming back with my payday might convince Deb to give me another shot to be the husband she hoped for when we got married. Cal must be three by now. I wonder if she still sings as she runs from room to room in search of fun. Cal never stops running and sings all day long. I miss the hug she used to give me when I walked through the front door of our little hovel on Trappist 3 Station. Even if I came home with empty pockets having lost it all in a game of cards, Cal still rushed over with a huge smile, squeezed me tight, and made me feel loved. Getting back to my wife and little girl is all I can think about. The walls are flat and sleek, like something left behind a melted tunnel that got refrozen by the frigid environment. I have been drifting down for nearly 20 minutes when my flashlight finally finds the bottom. A slimy pile of rotting remains from the organism that carved this hole awaits me. At least my landing will be soft. I drag my hand against the slick wall to slow my descent before I plunge into the mountain of dead fungus. After flopping around in the mushy glob, which clings to the exterior of my rubber suit, I roll onto a rocky floor and find myself in a vaulted underground cavern. I'm in awe of what I see. Hundreds of colossal fungal stalks rise from floor to ceiling, illuminating the rock-walled cave with a gentle turquoise glow from bioluminescent veins that run up the height of their pale trunks. It's breathtaking. My little Cal would love the untouched natural beauty of this place. A warning klaxon ruins the moment. There's a red wind gust symbol flickering in the bottom left corner of my HUD. The onboard oxygen tank is about to hit empty. I forgot how fast the old emergency tanks run out, and should have thought about topping it off with the remnants of my boat's life support before venturing out. My hands shake with fear as I tap the wrist-mounted touchscreen console to activate my suit's environmental analysis app. It will tell me if the air is breathable or not. Like most things in my possession, it's busted. An error code flashes across the HUD, telling me to replace the testing intake fan's tiny motor. Of course, I don't have the tools or parts to do that, so it's going to be another blind leap. I take one last breath, squeeze the air tight in my chest, and twist off my helmet. There's a hiss, and my ears pop from the sudden depressurization. I'm not planning to die in the confines of an ill-fitting rubber tomb. The cave is warm and humid, echoing with an ensemble of dripping water as drops of melted ice float from the ceiling into pools that surround the base of each glowing stalk. The pools look like little moats surrounding huge living towers. I hold my final breath for as long as I can until my chest starts to burn. When my willpower erodes, I exhale and expect to suffocate on a big breath of vacuum. Instead, my lungs fill with air and stop burning. I take another breath, and then another. The damp cave smells musty and earthy. How could this be possible? "Fuck yeah!" I shout to celebrate my survival. My words carry through the cave, unhampered by the thin air. No wonder my boat didn't find this place during my orbital scans. The air is too thin, and the humidity is too dense to be detected under the thick surface ice. Breathing might be a little tougher, but my body should adapt to taking deeper breaths to fill my lungs. Even walking around makes me feel a little lightheaded. I'll just have to avoid any strenuous activity, which is fine by me. I've never been the kind of person who likes working up a sweat anyway. The fungal stalks, including the dead one that I traversed, must have formed a seal that traps air down here. Maybe oxygen is a byproduct of whatever they do with the water at their base. This cave has it all, water, air, and warmth. I might have a shot to survive here if I can find some food. On the fifth rotation, I've eaten the last of the bland protein bars in the emergency kit from my boat. Now my stomach rumbles and groans with the pain of hunger. My energy levels are plummeting. It's coming time to roll the dice again. While exploring the cavern, I found fist-sized spore pods scattered below the whitest fungal stalks. The pod's exterior is tough, but peels away to reveal a slimy oval of sweet-smelling pulp. I pick up the freshest spore pod I can find, peel away the shell, and hesitate before taking a nibble. It tastes bitter and earthy, with a chalky texture that melts on my tongue like a claggy mousse. I gag but manage to get it down and keep it down. By the next rotation, I haven't suffered any adverse reaction to the pod and decide to devour three of them. Each bite is a struggle, but the cramps of starvation drive me to keep eating. I forgot how it feels to have a full stomach and to have some energy. I feel like I've finally exhausted the bad luck that's been stalking me for my entire life. Three rotations later, bloated by a spore pod feast, I have the strength to keep exploring the expansive cave network. As I'm strolling the stony path through the endless forest of pale stalks, I notice their turquoise veins flash when I get close. Are they trying to communicate with me? I get creative and grab the flashlight from my crumpled rubber suit next to the dead mass of fungus, rush over to the nearest stalk, and flash the light twice. On, off. On, off. The turquoise veins pulse twice in reply with the exact same cadence of conversation. It could be the change in the flashlight's electrical field, or they can sense the photons from the beam of light. The details don't matter. I've been craving social contact since I got here, and they're open to talking. It's been almost 30 rotations according to the probe's tracker. I head over to the dead fungus, using the hole in the ice to connect with the probe every now and again to do a manual scan for any passing boats. I used to feel excitement at the prospect of being found. Now I'm on the brink of accepting that I might live out my life on this icy rock forever. I think the spore pods might have a euphoric effect. If I wait too long between meals, I start to feel anxiety creep from somewhere deep inside. I do everything I can to keep that horrible feeling away, eating more and more of them. I've even come to enjoy the bitter aftertaste that lingers after each feast. I've fallen in love with life in this cave. Fresh water drips from the ceiling, melted by heat that radiates from the fungal stalks. Food is abundant, and I've made a friend. I spend most of my time talking with the stalk that I named Cal after my little girl. My hand is cramped from flicking the flashlight on and off so many times. I feel close to her, even though I don't think either of us really understands the conversations we have. I haven't cracked the enigma of their language, but am making progress. I belong here. Living in the forest of titanic fungal stalks has shown me what it feels like to have a real home. I've spent my entire life hopping from rock to rock, running from problem after problem. Here, my value isn't determined by the size of my wallet, and there's no contracts to chase. I can just be me, and it feels damn good. I never want to leave. Cal has convinced me that the probe is more a threat than path to redemption. It took me some time to figure out what the patterns meant, but I have come to understand that their language expresses emotion rather than words. I thought Cal would enjoy a glimpse of the surface, and came up with a way to share the data from the probe's 360 visual optics. I amplified the probe's transmission signal to penetrate the thick ice, converted the visual output into radio waves, and stood next to Cal to use my orange survival suit as a relay when I connected with the probe. Her veins flashed with a frantic display that communicated great suffering. With each turquoise pulse, I could feel her pain. As the signal flooded the cave, the other stalks flashed their bioluminescent veins, screaming with agony. The crowd trembled as the stalks retracted from the ceiling and folded their great caps against their bodies to shield themselves from the electromagnetic onslaught. That explains why I didn't see them from orbit. The frequencies of my boat scanner must have caused them to retract below the ice. I got lucky that their folded caps maintained the seals that kept the oxygen from flooding out of the cave and into the vacuum on the surface. Once I understood that the probe could hurt my new family, I knew what had to be done. My use of technology is a poison to them. Seeing Cal in so much pain made it clear that I need to protect them in a way that I could never protect my real family by doing something selfless for once. I reduced the signal amplification, wandered over to the hole in the ice, and reactivated my connection with the probe. I input a transit order to send it back to my boat, and program a delayed subroutine to pull its graphite control rods when it gets there, causing the onboard nuclear reactor to melt down. I'm hoping my act will deter others from coming to my icy dwarf planet in search of my radiotrophic family. As I take off my helmet for the last time, I can't help but smile. I'm glad that desperation drove me here. I never expected to find an oasis on the edge of the Trappist system. Cal's chattiness and curiosity used to remind me so much of my daughter, but now I can't even picture her face. I spend most of my time harvesting dozens of spore pods from the ground, but can never seem to collect enough to satiate my voracious appetite for them. Eventually, I've eaten every pod I can find. I feel creeping anxiety bubbling in my gut. There's more than hunger driving me. I search the entire cavern twice over, but can't find a single pod to consume. Cal beckons me over with a brilliant flash. It's the brightest signal her veins have produced since I got here. Maybe she can feel my agitation. Her turquoise veins pulse from bottom to top. They keep flashing in a way I've never seen before. She's trying to tell me something. I look up. There they are, at the very top of her massive form, resting just below the ceiling of solid ice. She's showing me three spore pods, out of reach, but close enough for me to harvest thanks to dwarf planet's low gravity. My mouth waters at their sight. I push my feet against the ground and propel myself upward. I'm almost in reach of the pods when my foot grazes Cal's stalk, which has a sticky membrane that yanks my body against her warm, pale flesh. I wiggle, I squirm, I twist and pull. Nothing works. I can't get out. I'm a fly who landed on a strip of flypaper, lured by the prospect of a good meal. Hunger rumbles in my belly again. A migraine comes hard and fades hard. Then the shivers hit for a while the spore pod's grip wanes. Even with a clear mind, I can't escape Cal's sticky embrace. Cal. No. How could I lose sight of getting back to her? It's the only thing that ever mattered to me. I close my eyes and picture her beautiful smile. I can hear the song she used to sing from her crib when she was supposed to be napping. How did things turn out so bad? The fungal stalk trembles and sways. Its veins pulsate with excitement. I can feel it starting to wrap around my body. In a rotation or two, it will fully envelop me. Loser, lowlife, leech. Those words keep streaming through my mind when I start to feel the burn of the stalks digest.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Festive juices.
And there you go. There you go. Whoa, Chris, thank you indeed. What a story, man. An original Starship Sofa. Chris, thank you so much. Mark, there's a virtual bear hug coming over the waters for you there, lad. Thank you. Yes, big bear hug, Jordy bear hug for you. Thank you. So, we have got our very own Amy H. Sturgis. Ames!
Hello, my friends. It's time for another look back on genre history. And I have something special to share with you today. I'd like to share with you the contents of a presentation I recently made, and that presentation is related to my new book project that I am working on right now, and I'm excited to share that with you. Is it related to genre history? Yes, but it's related to, well, several different genres. But never fear, there is science fiction content here, and in the process of talking about these ideas, I will emphasize and recommend one science fiction work in particular. This presentation that I made early in May 2024 is called Missing Students and Their Fictional Afterlives, True Crime, Crime Fiction, and Dark Academia. And I presented that at the Guilty Pleasures Examining Crime in Popular Culture Conference, sponsored by the Popular Culture Research Network. And I'm not going to give you the presentation verbatim. I will wander around a bit. But again, although it's not completely focused on science fiction, there is science fiction content. And also, I'm just excited to share with you what I'm working on right now. So I hope you will enjoy this and find something of interest here. Again, this is Missing Students and Their Fictional Afterlives, True Crime, Crime Fiction, and Dark Academia. Students don't just vanish into thin air until they do. And when they do, they leave a hole, a haunted space that classmates and campuses and communities seek to fill. And questions that storytellers, including the authors of crime fiction and its often overlapping relative, dark academia, seek to answer. One such student who left a haunted space was Bertha Mellish, a junior student at Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Massachusetts, who disappeared from her campus in November of 1897 and was never seen again. Now, two 21st century authors have addressed her 19th century unsolved mystery in very different novels, effectively mapping the imaginative and popular space where true crime, crime fiction, and dark academia meet. But before I talk about the Bertha Mellish case and its fictional afterlives, I should first define key terms. As Martin Edwards notes in The Life of Crime, Detecting the History of Mysteries and Their Creators, from 2022, quote, "A crime story has as its main focus the revelation of the truth about a crime. That truth concerns, typically, who done it, how done it, why done it, or who was done in. Beyond that, pedantry seems pointless. Most people recognize a crime story when they see one," end quote. Okay, fair enough. In my dark academia class I teach, and also in my essay, Dark Arts and Secret Histories, Investigating Dark Academia, which was published in 2023 in the Potterversity anthology, I've concluded that the literary genre of dark academia, which is a separate category from the aesthetic, rests on the foundation of four key cornerstones. And I've talked about this before on Starship Sofa, so I'll be brief here. First, dark academia works connect in some vital way to the project of academia. Main characters are or were students or faculty members. The setting may be a school, college, or university campus, or a related space, such as a library or laboratory. Here you might think of science fiction classics like Frankenstein or The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, both of which have strong dark academia resonances. Dark academia tales emphasize research and learning. This might include the study of traditional or taboo academic subjects, for example, or the investigation of a campus or personal mystery. Second, dark academia works employ the Gothic to wildly oversimplify some of the insights of Gerald E. Hoegel in the Cambridge Companion to Gothic Fiction. This means, for example, the dark academia stories are rooted in setting, such as a campus with its signature architecture, atmosphere, and claustrophobia, absorbed with the past, either in general as a subject of study or with a recent personal past, and associated with secrets that are either physically or psychologically haunting. And you may recall that I've mentioned in the past that I see the Gothic as a forerunner of, a necessary condition for, modern science fiction, in the sense that Mary Shelley reversed Anne Radcliffe's formula for the Gothic explained, putting the explanation up front, saying, "This is plausible," and giving scientific credibility, plausibility, to the fantastical story to come. Third, dark academia earns the dark in its name. Its tales emphasize atmosphere, involve tragedy, and contemplate the theme of death in some way, featuring, for instance, the school-related death or disappearance. Therefore, many works of dark academia are also works of crime fiction. And last, dark academia stories interrogate power dynamics, often shining a spotlight on exclusivity, privilege, inequality, and hypocrisy. Campus-specific problems voice larger critiques about injustice in society. So, another way to think about it is that dark academia uses the intense and atmospheric backdrop of academia to address issues that, while often shown in high relief in that setting, are also universal. In the case of a vanished student, such as Bertha Mellish, storytellers ask, why and how could a student just disappear? Who is responsible? Was a crime committed? And if so, why? And by whom? And where is justice? And how can we learn from and avoid such a thing in the future? To be clear, Bertha Mellish is not the only missing student whose haunted space has spoken to crime fiction and dark academia storytellers. To acknowledge another case of lasting importance, we must go to Binnington College in Binnington, Vermont. On December 1, 1946, Binnington College sophomore Paula Jean Weldon, a student of botany who loved spending time in nature, went hiking a few miles from campus on Vermont's Long Trail. She was never seen again. Her disappearance remains an unsolved mystery, one that hasn't been forgotten. As Joshua Rupp says in his article, Alone in the World, from the Binnington Banner, this was 60 years later, in 2006, quote, on December 1st, we celebrated, sort of, the disappearance of Paula Weldon, a young college student who completely disappeared in 1946. The point is that it's fascinating how profound an effect someone not being there can create. An appalling hole forms, one that we subconsciously need to fill, end quote. One way we try to fill that hole is through storytelling. Echoes of Paula Weldon's disappearance from Binnington College may be found in multiple dark academia novels, including foundational works of the genre, such as 1951's Hangs a Man by Shirley Jackson, whose husband was a faculty member at Binnington College at the time of Weldon's disappearance, and 1992's, also whydunit crime fiction, The Secret History by Donna Tartt, who, as a graduate of Binnington College, inherited the campus lore about Weldon's disappearance. And to take the intersection of dark academia and crime fiction to another level, in 2014, author Susan Scarf Merrill wrote Shirley, a novel, exploring the premise that real-life Hangs a Man author Shirley Jackson might have been the one responsible for the real-life disappearance of student Paula Weldon. Considering works like Hangs a Man and The Secret History, you could say the haunted space left by the missing student is baked into the very DNA of dark academia storytelling. And speaking of foundational works, it's worth noting that one of the pioneering novels in the police procedural subgenre of crime fiction, Hilary Waugh's Last Seen Wearing from 1952, in retrospect itself a contributor to the tradition of dark academia storytelling, also responds to the unanswered questions left by Paula Weldon's disappearance. As Leslie S. Klinger notes, quote, Last Seen Wearing, the first acclaimed police procedural, veered sharply from earlier crime fiction. Weldon's disappearance was never solved, leaving Waugh free to craft a story. Influenced by the success of the radio program Dragnet, he decided to follow Lawrence Treat's lead in focusing on the police investigation, end quote. Klinger's insights here come from the introduction from the 2021 Library of Congress Crime Classics edition of 1952's Last Seen Wearing. A much more recent work is crime fiction with dark academia sections, but it's also speculative fiction, and I want to be sure to recommend and underscore this work, Erin Kate Ryan's Quantum Girl Theory from 2022. This novel underscores the ongoing need to address the haunted space left by the missing student, and it invites us into a thought experiment, a science fictional one, as we encounter a multiverse of options for what really happens to a missing girl. The universe fractures, and all of the theories, all of the possibilities are true. And to underscore Ryan's understanding of this hole that is left by a missing student and our need to fill it, she writes this in Quantum Girl Theory. Quote, on December 1st, 1946, Paula Jean Weldon put on a bright red parka, left her dorm for a hike on the Long Trail, and vanished into the thin mountain air of the trailhead. Once she is gone, a missing girl becomes everything that everyone thinks she might be. Our theories create her fate. She's a runaway. She's a maniac. She is bones shrouded in red cloth beneath an evergreen tree. She is double, triple, quadruple exposure of any lifetime anyone could dream. the hole she left somehow bigger than the space she once filled, end quote. Again, there's this refrain of the hole she left. Which brings us back then to Bertha Mellish. On November 18, 1897, junior student Bertha Lane Mellish went missing from Mount Holyoke College. Her disappearance remains an unsolved mystery, one with tantalizing clues left behind. You see, in the summer before the fall semester in which she disappeared, Bertha Mellish worked in a local mill. She was not only woman student then, but also factory girl, and that experience seems to have followed her back to Mount Holyoke College. For her rhetoric class at Mount Holyoke, Bertha Mellish wrote the short story La Petite, a Story of Mottawagan Mill. It was a work of Gothic fiction, using peril, tragedy, and pathos to recount a tale of a fictional young woman at a fictional mill, the victim of seduction who loses her position due to her liaison, a fallen factory girl who becomes an unwed mother, a disgraced woman who chooses death over what the story calls a, quote, shamed, stifled life, end quote. Now, on the one hand, it was nothing short of scandalous for a supposedly proper and sheltered Mount Holyoke student to write such a shocking story, displaying knowledge of, among other things, premarital sex, unplanned pregnancy, and suicide. But then again, Bertha Mellish was known to be not only an able scholar, but also a free thinker. The daughter of a minister, she self-identified publicly as an agnostic. Perhaps she was displaying her characteristic nonconformity through this assignment. But to some, it seemed suggestive that Bertha Mellish, soon to become the subject of a real-life Gothic mystery, had first authored this Gothic story. Her tale, her college class assignment, was published in 1897 in the newspaper The Willimantic Weekly Journal during the search for her, in case the tragic story spoke to her state of mind. So we have nested stories here, with Mellish's short story a possible clue to her own real-life mystery, a tale that others have now written in her haunting absence. Recently, two separate novels, The Buttonfield from 2014 and Killingly from 2023, have launched their own imaginative investigations into the disappearance of Bertha Mellish. The authors of these works, Gail Hush and Catherine Buettner, respectively, both professors, both experts on the Mellish case, ask similar questions about what happened in 1897 and craft very different narratives as answers. In The Buttonfield, Gail Hush centers Bertha Mellish's perspective, retroactively filling her haunted space with meaning. Hush portrays the pre-Mount Holyoke Bertha as hopeful about her college experience, telling herself, quote, in a few short weeks, a new life would begin, in a place where everything was possible. No disappointments would follow her there. She would be reborn, a butterfly released from its chrysalis, a winged creature ready to fly. Whatever her future held, Bertha knew it held no mills, end quote. Education, the author suggests Bertha believes, is the key to escaping her small town and its threat of conformity and constriction. Then, in a heartbreaking moment of foreshadowing, the newly arrived Bertha finds that the Mount Holyoke campus doesn't look like its pictures. Quote, with its red brick walls and its grid of identical black shuttered windows, the building reminded Bertha of the mill she had stood outside just the day before. The resemblance unnerved her, end quote. The college, she realizes, is just another factory. Her horizons aren't so broad after all. Hush follows Bertha through her journey to a, quote, stifled life, end quote, of increasing isolation, disillusionment, and withdrawal, and along the way implicates school and church and the societal expectations embodied in each, as well as, to a degree, Bertha herself in the final unfolding of her tragedy. But, in true dark academia fashion, Hush saves some of her most damning critique for the president of Mount Holyoke College, who, in this depiction, deflects the responsibility inherent in the How do you lose a student from your campus? Question. By choosing to leak Bertha's class assignment to the press, ensuring a grotesque kind of victim blaming, shifting the scandal of the short story's topic to the missing Bertha and her bereaved family, in order to protect an institution that had failed its student. Conversely, in her crime novel Killingly, Catherine Buettner spotlights those left behind to take up the investigation into the disappearance of Bertha Mellish. In Killingly, Bertha Mellish is tragic collateral damage in a time of intolerance and inequality that Buettner emphasizes is more like our own than we might wish to admit. Mount Holyoke College is certainly complicit in a system that led Bertha to lose her promising young life while seeking to conceal and end an unplanned pregnancy. But it's simply the world with its prejudices, double standards, and injustices made small and suffocating. The stifling experiences of, for example, Bertha's sister, her best friend, and the private investigator on the case give us other glimpses into those whose lives are lived half in shadow. And in Killingly, Bertha's short story reaches the press, not from the college, but from her father's hand, not as institutional self-protection, but instead as a plea for help in finding the missing young woman. And in a perverse sense, a veiled family confession to another crime, a terrible secret reflected only through the metaphors in the class assignment of a lost student. There are so many secrets that those investigating the case try to keep safe, secrets about Bertha and about themselves. As Buettner reminds us in her novel about her take on Bertha's truth, quote, "But we can read it now. We can listen. We can know," end quote. Research and investigation lead to knowledge, and knowledge empowers us. Both The Button Field, with its deep dive into the imagined mind of Bertha Mellish, and Killingly, with its fictional study of those investigating her disappearance, illustrate how fictional stories tackle real-life campus mysteries, speaking to our need to address the haunted spaces left by those who have vanished, to underscore that these lives mattered. Authors may hold up a mirror to our institutions and our actions, providing us with important insights we can use now. In so doing, they build an imaginative and meaningful space where true crime, crime fiction, and dark academia meet, and they keep the memory of the missing alive. Both Gail Hush and Catherine Buettner, in their very different novels, tell us emphatically that Bertha Mellish did not have to disappear, that students do not have to disappear. And if we study the lessons they would teach us, perhaps others won't. I thank you so much for the opportunity to share my research. Like I said, I am working on a book project right now related to these topics, and there are a lot of points at which there's overlap with speculative fiction and science fiction in particular. Missing students and their fictional afterlives invite extrapolation. They invite thought experiments, and where you have those, you often find science fiction too, and related genres like the Gothic tradition of dark academia, which includes many science fiction works. So I feel very much at home in this subject, even if it is not completely science fictional. Plus, I think genre history is just cool, including the history of other genres, like crime fiction. But I hope something here was of interest. It was a great delight to get to share this with you. And I look forward to joining you again when we do something completely different, when we get together to take another look back at genre history. Thank you.
Ames, there's another bear hug coming up. It's not quite as kind of roughy-toughy, but there's a little hug coming for you as well. Thank you, Indy. Ames, thank you so much. I'm trying to get Amy on that show, you know, but she's so busy, man. Just like, but so busy in science fiction and writing and books, which is like, you know, it's a cool job to be busy in. But Ames, thank you. Honestly, pleasure. So that is today's show, 732. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Listen, support if you can. That would be huge and immense. It really would. Just pop over the website. There's Patreon, there's PayPal. Do you know what I mean? Patreon is just like, keeps going, keeps this kind of Starships Over engines burning into the depths of space. Until next time, just like to say, good night from me.
Thank you for listening. Time soon, can you reach me? Is my signal getting through? Turn on your radio, I wanna talk to you. This signal's going light speed. By the time I get my say, I might already be on to you and on my way. But you're so far from here. At best I'm moving slow, so I'm waiting on your call at home with nowhere to go. Can you reach me? Is my signal getting through? Turn on your radio, I wanna talk to you. I wanna talk to you. Cast myself on a radio wave, I might get to you someday. If books were rocket ships, I'd need only the will to fly. I'm still building word by word, and I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.